Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful, beautiful, fantastic Williams scene with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Rivertown Kids. That's on the album, the Grammy-winning album, Tomorrow's Children. I do want to start by sending out our condolences and our deep-felt sorrow with the passing of Toshi Seeger. Toshi, Pete's wife of, I think, 70 years, passed away this past week. She was 91. She was a fantastic human being, absolutely gorgeous, brilliant, powerful, loving, competent, hard-driving soul, Toshi Seeger. Just was, as Pete would say, the brains of the Seeger family. She was his partner, his soulmate. Everything Pete did, Pete Seeger did, and his life was certainly strengthened, empowered, pushed forward by the wonderful Toshi Seeger, who's now left us. Our condolences to Pete. I can't imagine what he's going through. I had the great pleasure of spending time with them. I have to say, on a personal note, of all the women I've ever met, Toshi Seeger most reminded me of my own sainted mother. She was, although I used to tell her she didn't look Jewish, but she was just a fantastic human being, and we are deeply sorrowful at the departure of Toshi Seeger, but grateful for the years we had with her. She was just absolutely wonderful, and the world will not be the same without her, that's for sure. And Pete, our hearts go out to you and to your entire family for the departure at the loss of this great and magnificent woman, Toshi Seeger. We love you, Toshi, and we hope everything is well. Today we are going to veer into an area that Pete Seeger dealt with, social justice, the power of corporations, the need to retrieve our society from the power of the corporations. We are joined by Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols from Nation Books, a book called Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, with a foreword by Bernie Sanders, no shrinking violet himself. Robert, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. We're going to give you the whole hour, so we're really going to explore in depth what you mean by dollarocracy.
Well, it's great to be here, Harvey. I'm looking forward to it.
Good, good, good. So let's start from the top and tell us what is this title, dollarocracy? What's it mean?
Well, it means pretty much what it says. Instead of a democracy, the rule of the people, it's a dollarocracy. It's the rule of money. And instead of having one person, one vote, and the effective rule of law with people being political equals, we have $1, one vote, and those with the most money therefore get the most votes and completely dominate the political system. So our book is about this process of dollarocracy and the crucial role the election system in particular has come to be tamed, neutralized, domesticated, or just flat out corrupted, so that it no longer really provides a vehicle for democratic expression and participation.
That's small d democratic. We're not talking about the Democratic Party here. As a matter of fact, on your dust jacket, you started out when President Barack Obama was reelected, some pundits argued that despite unbridled campaign spending, here was proof that big money couldn't buy elections. The exact opposite was the case. Are you implying, Robert Chip McChesney, that big money owns even the Democratic Party and even our radical Barack Obama?
Indeed, I am. And I think that, you know, we talk a lot about the Democrats because, you know, we use the term dollarocracy and dollarcrats a lot in the book. And there's no question that the modern contemporary Republican Party is completely in the tank for big money, gleefully in the tank for anything to enhance the power of the wealthy, of corporations, and diminish the power of everyone else. But, you know, they have moved to the right, and everyone has talked about that in the last 40 years. But the Democratic Party's made a similar move to the right in the wake of the Republicans. And the commanding heights of the Democratic Party now, I think, have been, and have been really since the 1970s, late 70s, very much junior partners, if not full partners, in all the policies we talk about that would go under the heading of dollarocracy. Now, at the same time, Harvey, what we emphasize in the book, the voting base of the Democratic Party is significantly more progressive to the left than the heads of the Democratic Party. And you'll see backbenchers in the Democratic Party who are fantastic, but they rarely have any power, meaningful power. And
Now you use the term political. This term, Bob, backbencher. That's really a term from the British Parliament. Can you tell me, what do you mean by backbencher?
A backbencher is someone like, in British Parliament, it refers to someone in one of the parties who has no power, even though they're in Parliament, so they sit in one of the back benches. And they can sometimes be gadflies, but they're really irrelevant to how things get done in Parliament. And we have those in American politics, too. Ron Paul was a backbencher in the Republican Party. Dennis Kucinich should have been a classic backbencher in the Democratic Party. They pronounce strong opinions, but they have no influence over how the party operates or what gets done.
So these are people who actually stand for something, who have principles, who believe in things, but nobody pays them any mind. And so they're shoved to the back of the audience there, of the peanut gallery. And even though they're members of the Parliament or of the Congress, you're saying they have no clout in the crowding of the way the power structure works.
And I think since about the mid to late 1970s, the Democratic Party's commanding heights have become very comfortable with sort of a corporate-run society. They've become much less interested in protecting and preserving and promoting the rights of organized labor, which has always been sort of an anomaly or contradiction. Why on earth wouldn't the Democratic Party, which would win more elections if there was a stronger organized labor movement, why wouldn't it devote more resources to it? And I think the Democratic Party at the commanding heights made it sort of pact with the sort of new world order of a diminished unionism as being, you know, the way of the future, and they weren't going to mess with that.
Okay, and here's something that, as a historian, I've always, this is a pet peeve I have, and since you've written Dollarocracy, you just mentioned the magic word labor union, and I want everybody to understand that the first people that Hitler picked up when he took power in 1933 in what became Nazi Germany was not the Jews. It was the trade union leadership. These are the people that he went after first to consolidate his power. Many of them happened to be Jews, but that's not why he picked them up. There cannot be, and Bob McChesney, I think you'll agree with me, there cannot be any kind of effective democracy in an industrial or post-industrial society without a strong labor union or a strong labor movement.
Not only do I agree with you, Harvey, I think in our book what we argue is that the modern notion of dollarocracy becoming the reigning political movement in the United States really was launched in the 1970s, and it was launched by the Chamber of Commerce and powerful, wealthy corporate CEOs and billionaires, inspired by a memo written by Lewis Powell, who went on to become a Supreme Court justice. And their whole argument at that period was that it was imperative that business resume its proper role in taking over the government and having the government work primarily to satisfy the needs of business. And the problem the United States had in the 1960s and early 70s was that all sorts of traditionally apathetic people like students, African Americans, women were getting, you know, uppity. They were getting too involved in politics. They were making demands in the system. And it was imperative to sort of put them back in their place and let the traditional rulers rule. And central to this mission, right at the front, and really the heart and soul of dollarocracy for the last 40 years has been smashing organized labor, because they've understood not only does labor, organized labor, impinge upon the immediate profits of companies by raising workers' salaries, not only does it impinge upon the ability of corporations and businesses to do whatever they want because organized labor can sort of positively affect the work environment in a way that business doesn't want to do because it costs them money, But beyond that, even more important, they understood, and they still to this day understand, organized labor was the only institution in society that had the ability to raise the money and develop the political power to actually be an effective counterbalance to corporate power. So they know if they could eliminate organized labor, the ability of big money to basically run the board and take over the government would be much greater. There'd be really no serious obstacle to it. And that, I think they've been proven correct.
Well, there's one critical piece of legislation that, as a historian, has fascinated me, and it's astounding to me that and it's the Taft-Hartley Act, which was passed after World War II over the veto of Harry Truman, and it severely restricts the abilities of public unions to organize. And what's astonishing to me is that that law has survived intact the 8 years of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, the four of Jimmy Carter, the eight of Bill Clinton, and now the terms of Barack Obama. Why is it that with majorities in the White House and Congress, that especially in the 60s, the Democrats have never gotten around to repealing Taft-Hartley?
You know, I think from the 70s on, it's because they didn't want to, and they really haven't moved very hard to do anything to help trade unions advance and maintain their position, let alone advance. The 60s is a different – I don't know the answer to that. I would like to know the answer to that question. What I don't know is how much organized labor itself made that a defining issue, because I was a young man then, very young, in fact, but I was following politics closely. I don't recall that as being a rallying cry for organized labor, say, in the late 60s or early 70s. It may have been, and I might have just been not paying attention, though.
Well, if there was ever a time to repeal Taft-Hartley, it would have been somewhere between 1961, when John Kennedy took power, and 1965, when Lyndon Johnson tragically and idiotically escalated the war in Vietnam. But I was, I must be older than you, but I don't recall a rallying cry around Taft-Hartley either. And here we've had this bill, this law in place for since 1947, crippling unionization. The Democrats have had their time. Bill Clinton never said a word about it. Obama certainly hasn't said a word about it, and it remains on the books. And it remains useful to the Republicans and to big business to crippling the unions. It's quite astounding, actually.
Well, I think it shows the extent to which, and this is much more so the case today than it was in 1965, that the Democratic Party really has just cynically and shamelessly played labor, because they know that Republicans are an absolute nightmare. They're out to actually destroy organized labor completely, and they are more so today than ever in their history. So the Democrats just say, we're not quite as bad as them, and they get organized labor every election just crawling in all fours, doing whatever they can to get these guys elected. And then as soon as the election's over, labor can barely get a meeting with an intern at the White House. I mean, they have no role whatsoever.
Yeah, it's pathetic. Of course, some of it has to do with the nature of organized labor itself. I mean, we haven't really had much dynamism from the labor movement since Walter Reuther at the United Auto Workers. But I guess the SEIU has jumped in here and there. But if there is a route to the power of corporations in this country, it is the decimation of the labor movement. Of course, nobody knows anything about the labor movement in this country. I wrote a book, a history of the United States from 1860 to 1920, when organized labor was in its heyday, and the great Eugene V. Debs was out there. And Eugene V. Debs, the great socialist leader from Terre Haute, Indiana, has become a non-person. Eugene V. Debs was the most powerful, most popular, most loved public figure in American on the American scene, political scene, between 1900 and 1920, and yet he barely appears in any history books. It's staggering.
I couldn't agree more.
He was a great socialist. So, Bob McChesney, let's talk about ballotocracy a bit. I was especially fascinated, and it's very important that people know the story of the two men that I consider to be the most important players in the legalized coup d'etat staged by the union, by the corporations in this country, who are Lewis Powell and now John Roberts. Lewis Powell being a justice of the U.S. Well, I don't like to use the word justice in the same sentence with guys like Lewis Powell, Antonin Scalia, or John Roberts, but I suppose if you ever have an alternative, let me know. But members of the U.S. Supreme Court, Lewis Powell and then John Roberts, you do a really great job in Delawareocracy of talking about their roles and the continuity between the two of them in establishing corporate power in this country. Can you narrate a story of these two men and what they've done?
Yes, and they do play a large role in our book. We have a whole chapter devoted to them, a long chapter. And Lewis Powell, I think a lot of Americans know, as a Supreme Court justice for roughly 15 years. He was always presented as a centrist and a moderate. He was a Southern Democrat, a corporate lawyer from Virginia, who one of his major clients was the tobacco industry. And Lewis Powell had turned down several opportunities to be appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon during Nixon's first term because he didn't want to give up his income and his prestige. And while still an attorney before joining the Supreme Court in 1971, Powell wrote a memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which basically said, and I referred to it not too long ago, basically said that business was at a complete low ebb in American society. It had the least amount of respect for corporate power. Young people, middle-class young people who traditionally were the backbone of conservative and pro-business politics in advanced societies, advanced democracies, were turning against business. And increasingly seeing it as irrelevant and a negative force in society. And Powell said that it was imperative that business suddenly devote lots of money to taking over the government, to controlling the politics. And this would be, he saw it as a multi-front war. It meant taking over the media, making the media more sympathetic to business, to conservatives, doing the same at universities and education and with think tanks, influence journalism, really changed the culture. More and also dramatically increased the amount of lobbying in Washington. And within a decade of after Lewis Powell's memo, corporate America just really increased by tenfold the amount of lobbyists that are working full-time in Washington, D.C. And the whole notion of K Street, the lobbyist street, was born. And in that memo, also what was mentioned crucially by Lewis' memo, how important it was to take over the court system, that the Supreme Court and all the federal courts and the state courts had too many liberals on them who were, like, not sympathetic to the important role of business and the reason business had to dominate society. Now, ironically, Powell himself, within a year or so of that memo, was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That memo was not discussed in his confirmation hearings. He won 99-1. The only vote against him was Fred Harris. But as soon as Powell got on the court, he immediately went to work with one of his pet issues, which was allowing corporations and billionaires to spend as much as they wanted on political races with no strings attached. Now, this was such a radical idea in the 70s and 80s and 90s that William Rehnquist opposed him at every turn, and it never got any traction. I mean, they chipped away at the idea in a variety of cases, and they were able to cut back on the laws that gave public interest standards for elections and protected the integrity of elections to a certain extent. But it really wasn't until after Powell had gone and had been the court had been turned over by from Rehnquist to John Roberts that the bottom came out of the cup. And John Roberts is a product of Delawareocracy. I mean, you should understand that, you know it used to be, you'll remember this, Harvey, before Nixon, when Republicans would appoint members, people of the U.S. Supreme Court, that, it was sort of roll the dice. You might get an Earl Warren, or even under Nixon, you got a Harry Blackmun. You would get people who would, become independent judges, and they would come to their own opinions, and they oftentimes would evolve and become quite liberal. Well, that ends with Delawareocracy. From now on, all Supreme Court justices are carefully vetted, like Scalia, like Roberts, like Alito, like Clarence Thomas. So there's no chance of slippage. They're political ideologues and, frankly, I think political hacks, first and foremost, to get on the court and to be appointed. And Roberts is clearly a political hack. I mean, he came on the court, and we've never had a Supreme Court justice so obsessed with a handful of issues to advance corporate power. Like Lewis Powell, he was obsessed with getting rid of any limits on corporate and billionaire spending on elections, and hence we got Citizens United. When the Citizens United case came originally before the U.S. Supreme Court, it was actually being argued on very narrow grounds. It wasn't being argued as a let's get rid of all limits on corporate and billionaire spending and campaigns. Roberts sent the case back, said re-argue it on broader grounds. He already knew the opinion he wanted to write even before the facts of the case were heard. He was so obsessed with this. The other two issues where Roberts has had a similar passion has been with voting rights. It was a given that he would smash the protection to voting rights in the Voting Rights Act. I mean, there was never any question. That was like with Citizens United, that was a mission-critical dollarocracy issue. And the third area was there have been a variety of cases. We document some of them in the book. There are more that have happened since then to limit or eliminate organized labor. He's obsessed with that as well. Now, Roberts is actually fairly pragmatic otherwise. He doesn't mind monkeying around on gay rights or some other stuff. He's not going to like challenge, but when it comes to class power, corporate power, the ability of the rich to run the government without interference by the poor, he is the most, you know, firm, unrepentant, unyielding figure in the history of the American court. And we see the results around us. It's an absolute disaster.
Okay, Bob McChesney, a very good, very detailed and thorough outline here of the tale of Lewis Powell, a member. I will not use the word justice in the same sentence with these guys. So, a member of the Supreme Court appointed by Richard Nixon to the chief of the Supreme Court now, John Roberts. It's a corporate lineage where these guys have really had one major agenda item, which is put corporations totally in power in the United States. Now, as you went through that, Bob, you mentioned a couple of people. First of all, Fred Harris, the only person to vote against Lewis Powell being approved in the Supreme Court. Tell us, please, who Fred Harris was.
Well, Fred Harris was a two-term senator in Oklahoma. He's still alive, still going strong. He was elected at the age of 36 in 1964 in the LBJ landslide over Goldwater. And he was unquestionably the most radical member of the Senate while he was there for his two terms. And he ran for president in 1972, an ill-fated campaign, but he did make a campaign run of it. And Harris opposed Lewis Powell, and he said simply, I look at him and I see someone who doesn't understand or care for the interests of the great common people of this country. And I think he absolutely saw right through Lewis Powell for what he was, which was a shill for the largest corporations, a corporate lawyer who held the great bulk of American people in contempt. So well, that's Fred Harris's history.
Fred Harris, senator, two-term senator from Oklahoma. He must be, what, in his 90s now?
He was 36 and 64, so that was 50 years ago, so he'd be 85, 84.
Yeah, okay. So Fred Harris must have read Lewis Powell's infamous memo, and I encourage everyone listening to the show to look up in Dollarocracy and take a look at, track down the memo that Lewis Powell wrote. It's actually one of the most important documents in American history, laying out how the corporations would take over America, although there's one thing missing from it, and I do want to get to that in a couple of minutes with Bob McChesney here, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy from Nation Books. You also mentioned William Rehnquist. Now, many people I know listening to the show will only dimly recall who William Rehnquist was. I recall him because I teach a course in cultural and ethnic diversity at the Capital University here in Columbus, Ohio, and I've often had a wonderful guy come speak to us named Mark Welsh, a Native American who has recently passed away, unfortunately. And Mark went to, and I have to tell this story because it's an astonishing story. Two Native Americans were fired from their positions in Oregon in the 80s because they took peyote, as they told their employers they would, at a religious gathering, and were fired. They failed their drug test and were fired and were denied unemployment benefits. This story has a point about William Rehnquist. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court based on religious freedom. And Mark Welsh was in the hall in the Supreme Court listening to the arguments. And William Rehnquist, who was then the chief of the Supreme Court, said, and I quote, "The First Amendment does not apply to Native Americans." In this book, you're talking about what Rehnquist actually is on a different side of the case. Can you tell us, please, about William Rehnquist and who he was and how he gave way in what important ways to John Roberts?
Well, William Rehnquist was the first of the truly highly partisan Supreme Court justices was appointed. It was known when he was first appointed by Nixon as an associate justice of the Supreme Court in the 70s. He had sort of cut his teeth working in voter suppression campaigns in Arizona to try to keep the black and person of color voter to minimum so Republicans would have a better chance to win elections. I mean, he literally worked on this. So it was known. And this is a controversial guy. You're putting someone in who's has racist history. And he was known as the most ideologically right-wing person to run the court. I mean, he was put on the court for exactly that reason. And then when the Berger retired in the 1980s and Reagan is president, the Chief Justice Berger, he selected Rehnquist to become the new Chief Justice. And he served as Chief Justice for around 20 years. And he was known for being the most conservative justice in the modern era, in modern politics. And what's striking to us, and your is discussion of race, I think you nailed it, and that anecdote captures his history, of a person who's singularly unsympathetic to minorities in everything about the person. But what's striking to us as we looked at his rulings on a number of cases related to money and politics was that he was still not on board with the new go-go era of dollarocracy. He said, look, the Supreme Court, all our constitutional rulings have been real clear that corporations aren't people. They're chartered by the government. They're created by the government. They can't be given the same rights as people. They can't be treated in any way a similar form. They're very different. And they're subservient, ultimately, to people and to the Constitution. And this sort of is an old-school conservative still. And to Rehnquist's great credit, astonishingly, Rehnquist said, look, there's been 100 years of decisions by governments at the state, local, and national level on campaigns and corporations. And they've all of them, without exception, whenever the voters and legislators have studied it and considered the matter, thought it important to have a level playing field, not to allow rich people and corporations to spend too much. And he said it's really not the position of the Supreme Court to overturn what is the will of the people, obviously, with our own theory that we've come up with. And that's exactly once he was gone, they got rid of that type of thinking. You know, no place for that, and brought in Roberts, who said, of course, once we get a majority of the Supreme Court, the whole idea is to make sure our way of thinking becomes the law of the land. It became sort of like a permanent constitutional convention for Roberts and his cronies.
It is astounding. We're talking with Bob McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy. We're going to take a short break here, listen to Dana Ryan sing his Rocky Top version of Solartopia, get some announcements in, and we will be right back. Bob McChesney will stay with us for the second half hour. A lot more to talk about corporate power in the United States. Thank you so much, and we'll be back in a moment.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide traffic.
All right, Solartopia. With my good friend Dana Lyons, that's the Rocky Top version of Solartopia. I love that. We are with Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We're followed by Bernie Sanders. Bob McChesney, in the earlier part of the show, we discussed backbenchers. Do we consider Bernie Sanders a backbencher?
He's a backbencher in terms of power, but I think for a lot of Americans, including myself, he really represents what a public servant ought to be, an elected official who really cares first and foremost about their constituents and about the future of the country and not about how well corporations do. And along that line, Harvey, some of the research you do in the book that was really interesting is in the last year and a half or 2 years, there have been major studies published by Princeton University's press by political scientists, and we cite them in the book, from Yale and Berkeley and Stanford. And they reached the identical conclusion that really explains dollarocracy in a nutshell, which is that they determined that if you want to understand how the government works in America, the federal government, that it has the effect or the opinions of poor people, working class, middle class people, the overwhelming majority of the population, have absolutely no influence in the government whatsoever. That the government basically responds to the wealthy. They run the government. And these are like mainstream political scientists that come up with this in independent studies. And that's no surprise to any American. If you live in this country, you sort of figured that out a long time ago when you look at how the government works. But it's still astonishing to see this verified by our best political scientists.
Yes. And now, my own book, Harvey Washington's History of the United States, written way back in 1972, I talked mostly about the period between 1860 and 1920. And, of course, after the Civil War, the corporations took over, the whole government again in the Gilded Age, or prior, let's put it that way, in the Gilded Age, Morgan, Rockefeller, Carnegie, all those malefactors of great wealth, as the Roosevelts called them, they ran the show. And I guess in the 20th century, thanks to the rise of the labor movement and all that, we did have a breath of some democracy, but that's been taken away now. I want to put forward, you don't really discuss this too much in Dollarocracy, and I am about to put out a piece about this, but my theory is that what happened in response to the 1960s, the wonderful Cultural Revolution, which has yet to end, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, the corporations made an alliance with the right-wing church. And, you know, corporations have always been with us, certainly since the Civil War. They've ebbed and flowed to a certain extent in power, but mostly they've flowed. They never had really an army of foot soldiers. And when the right-wing church rose up in dismay of the fabulous time, they suspected all of us were having just way too much fun in the 1960s and 70s with the counterculture. The right-wing church really became the foot soldiers of the corporate takeover. And that's really how they grabbed control to a certain extent, at least at the grassroots, with some power that they should never have had. I think that some of that power, that alliance is starting to diminish. I mean, with the success of the gay rights movement to start to win on gay marriage, with the legalization of marijuana in Washington and Colorado, and we hope a winding down of the drug war, that some of that alliance is starting to be shaken. What do you think about that?
I think that's really accurate. In fact, you know, I think this marriage of billionaires and corporations, Chamber of Commerce, with right-wing religious lunatics and abortion opponents, and even most important of all, racists, white supremacists. You know, it was always an opportunistic relationship. The corporate CEO crowd, I mean, I suspect they were, you know, on matters like abortion rights, their kids certainly did that, and their family members did that. That was just, you know, and you know, Barry Goldwater was the president of Planned Parenthood in Arizona. I mean, he drove his own daughter to get her abortion, proudly said so. It was not a conservative issue until the 70s, and then it was for opportunistic reasons that they grabbed onto this. And the most important of these, again, was white supremacy and racism. By latching on to the racist legacy in America, especially the pronounced racist legacy in the southern states, it brought electoral victories that, you know, it managed to convert a lot of states that had fairly strong populist sentiments into hardcore right-wing states where the politicians worked very much against popular politics. And the race is a key factor. We still see it today. We've seen a state like West Virginia has been converted from one of the really most progressive states in the country to now it's become a southern state again, ironically. The state that was created to escape the Confederacy has now rejoined it. And I think a lot of it is due to racism being linked to corporate power. There's other issues as well, like the fact that Democrats don't give much to vote for. But the point simply, I think your analysis is right. And I think your second part of your analysis, the important part, is even more true, Harvey, which is that it's fracturing. You know, that sort of marriage they made with white supremacists, gay bashers, abortion rights haters, religious science haters, and public education haters, that alliance paid off when you had the numbers and it could deliver the electoral votes. But now, especially with Americans under the age of 30, that sort of stuff doesn't cut it anymore. And as with the demographic changes in the country, the Republican Party tied to these people can't really deliver the goods for the corporate bosses anymore because they can't win national elections. They're finding it harder and harder. Even what I would consider a weak candidate like Obama really didn't have that much trouble with Mitt Romney, and it's only going to be more so the same in the future. Hence the huge interest by the Roberts Court and by the Republican Party in state after state in dusting off voter suppression laws to make it really hard for poor people, people of color, students, young people, people who are considered unlikely to vote Republican to vote. I mean, cynical, shameless, transparently outrageous and obscene nonetheless. If they can win elections by suppressing the vote, they will, because I think what's going on in America today and why John and I are very hopeful in the book is that this is basically a pretty progressive country by American standards, certainly relative to the last several decades. And the corporate crowd, they can't win a fair election in this country. They've got to suppress the vote. They've got to have billionaires funneling money to the Cayman Islands to run negative ad campaigns. They have a hope of winning power. And it might be past the point they could ever win a national election again. That's that far down that road that they're reduced basically to gerrymandering and winning at the local level. So their future is looking pretty grim, and they're desperate.
Well, I'm gonna agree with you on most of that, and just say, of course, one of the astonishing things in my lifetime, and I'm 67 now, I was born the last day of 45, is the rise, the astonishing rise of the gay rights movement, not only the gay rights movement, but the power of the gay community. The first major national demonstration, got any attention for the gay community was in 1969 at the Stonewall Bar in New York City, which I think is still there, actually. And until that time, gays were just totally closeted. It was illegal to be gay in many places in this country. And the only person that I've seen in the American historical record who spoke forcefully in public for gay rights was Emma Goldman back at the turn of the century, the previous century, the great socialist feminist leader. And so from Stonewall until the present, we've gone from a totally closeted movement to really a very powerful political force. To the point that we now have Republican senators like Rob Portman and Dick Cheney, for God's sakes, talking about, gay marriage as being acceptable. And part of the reason, I think, is, of course, that the gay community is extremely well organized and very wealthy as an interest group. So the political landscape has totally changed. And now, of course, we have the Supreme Court, with the swing vote being Anthony Kennedy, who's from San Francisco, as it turns out. But nonetheless, overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. I mean, this is a huge deal. And probably you'd be very hard-pressed to find a social movement that's had a more rapid turnaround in American history than the gay rights movement, and it does change the political landscape. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I agree with you. It's an extraordinary story, one of the great victories, astonishing victories of the last decade, not to mention generation. It's been such a whirlwind, and it's just so impressive. But I think, it also we should understand, you mentioned Rob Portman and Dick Cheney. Of course, they have children who are gay, which I guess then gives a Republican politician sort of the right to be, not a homophobe. But I think there's another point here, too, which I think, the Dollarcrats are bashing gays, primarily for opportunistic reasons, so they could win elections. They thought those were the issues that would mobilize voters, not giving tax breaks to corporations. That's not going to get a lot of poor people or working class people excited. And I think there's just been a calculus, and this is really a decisive turn in the last 3 years, where I think the right wing realized that holding on to this gay bashing and homophobia issue was going to cost it more elections, cost it more political viability, would hurt the corporate agenda, than sort of putting up the white flag in that one and embracing it. And I think that's what we've seen take place. And that's probably why, in the end, it never really had any organized opposition, because the opposition gave up when they realized, the benefits of being homophobic were less now than the costs.
Well, I think that's also going to be true of the race issue. W.E.B. Du Bois said that the color line was the issue of the 20th century, and he was probably right. But, we do have, for better or worse, whatever he's worth to us now, and in corporate terms, Barack Obama is an African-American. I think it's ironic, or maybe not so ironic, or maybe just predictable, that the first African-American president is not descended from slaves. 90-whatever percent, a very high percentage of African-Americans, including Michelle Obama, are descended from slaves, but he's not. His father just was African, and his father was from Kenya, and his mother was from Kansas. But I think the issue of race, which you rightly say is being used as divisive, I think is less divisive, especially now that than it has been throughout U.S. history, especially with the rise of the Hispanic population since World War II. We actually now technically have a larger Hispanic population than we do African American, and as the immigration debate has showed, they're not to be messed with. And you know, between African Americans and Hispanics, who are over 30% of the population here, so the demographic landscape has really changed. And but the corporations managed to have transcended that. You know, they're still holding on to their power. One thing you haven't mentioned, and of course, Bob McChesney, co-author of which I'm Nicholas of Dollarocracy, you are founder of freepress.com, and your excellent organization. We haven't been able to talk yet about media and the corporations. Hopefully we'll do that in a bit. But I write for freepress.org. We tastefully coexist on the web. And one of the things that we talk about with my other friend, Bob, the great Bob Fitrakis, is the use of voting machines to steal elections. You've talked about disenfranchisement, and, of course, the Republicans and the corporations have really worked hard to prevent people of color, the poor people, from voting. We've been concerned with that, but also with the ability of the use of electronic voting machines to just flat-out flip and steal elections. Where do you think this falls in the Dollarocracy picture?
Well, in the conclusion of Dollarocracy, we call for, obviously, a broad-based movement to sort of arrest sort of corporate power and shift the tide back towards democracy with reforms of all our institutions, including elections. The starting point, we say, is we need a constitutional amendment which guarantees the right to vote. And when we spell that, to stop all the voter suppression, and it has a number of components to it, but one of the components is that you have not only the right to vote, to have your vote counted accurately. And that would mean that I think all these sort of electronic schemes where there's no record or the ability of people to come in and monkey with the algorithm, all that stuff's got to get thrown out. You've got a constitutional right to guarantee your vote's counted. I think that this sort of stuff shouldn't even have to be debated. I mean, this is just sort of elementary. If you're serious about elections, you've got to have them so people can trust them. And I think there's perfect grounds now to be cynical, skeptical, concerned about whether votes are counted accurately. And regrettably, we know there are a lot of people in the political system who have no qualms about breaking the rules if it will advance their agenda.
Well, it's been on, Chris. I had a bird's eye view here, or whatever you want to call it, in my front door here in Columbus, Ohio, in 2004, where there is zero doubt in my mind that that election was stolen, and it was stolen by electronic means. And instead, of course, the response in this country since 2000, when Al Gore was denied the presidency despite having won the popular vote by 500,000 votes and by clearly having won Florida, that was repeated with far greater sophistication in 2004 here in Ohio with Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State, being used by Karl Rove and Bush and Cheney to completely flip an election here in Ohio by electronic means. The response to that happening in those two elections is the spread of electronic voting machines. There are more electronic voting machines in use in the United States today than there were in 2004, and it's a nightmare. I mean, I don't see how a grassroots movement can ever win a national election in this country with electronic voting machines in place.
Well, I think you raised some issues that have got to be addressed. It's just not acceptable.
Right. I will say that Ireland had electronic voting machines and has thrown them out. Germany, Japan, Canada, a number of other countries use hand-counted paper ballots. To me, the restoration of any kind of American democracy has to start with the use of universal hand-counted paper ballots. A full week. We advocate a four-day weekend for voting Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, so that everyone can get to the polls. This idea of everybody voting on a Tuesday is highly repressive. But that was my message from freepress.org. We're with Bob McChesney, founder of freepress.com, co-author of Dollarocracy with John Nichols. Where do you think this is all going? I mean, Bob McChesney, how do we actually get rid of this dollarocracy and restore democracy to the American public?
Well, that's a great question. Let me just take a second, Harvey, because we really talked almost not at all except about the heart of the book, which is about what we call the money and media election complex. Because what we argue is now with unlimited money following Citizens United, there's this huge industry that's developed of consultants and super PACs, shadowy, secretive groups that raise all this money. And also a huge part of it is corporate media, because of the $10 billion, $6 billion ends up in that pocket of just a very small number of huge media companies that own the local TV station and cable outlets. And these companies, these media corporations, that own CBS, NBC, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, they are to campaign finance reform, they are to election reform what the National Rifle Association is to gun control or to efforts to ban assault weapons. They are this, and they make an enormous amount of money off the status quo. And it's given us the huge irony that, you know, this amount of money in politics wouldn't really be as much of a threat if we actually had great journalism covering campaigns, drawing people into public life, monitoring issues. Then the ads would be a pain in the ass and a nuisance, but you could ignore them for the most part. But instead, we have virtually no journalism left. The same companies that are raking in all this money are pretty much banned covering elections otherwise. And they were left basically at the mercy of these paid political ads, which I think are, you know, there aren't words to describe just how hideous they are. Most people try to put them out of their mind as soon as the election's over because they're so dirty, even having watched them. And so this is the system we've built in, and it's not changing. One of the things we do in the book that I'm proudest of is we have a chapter towards the end of original research and how the Internet is being brought into the money and media election complex. Because for a long time, the hope was that, well, we can go online and get the truth and find out who's spending all this money and learn about the candidates, and we can do an end run or a leapfrog over the big money influence, and popular politics can win, and all the politicians will have to ultimately answer to the people. And sadly, that promise has been, if not neutered, if not ended, it's certainly been neutered by what's taken place in the last few years. You know, we saw the NSA scandal that came out with Snowden's revelations in The Guardian in the last month. And if you read the book, you're going to find out that this has been well known to the political candidates, especially the Obama campaign, which really put together a dossier on virtually every American voter that would have made the NSA envious. They put all their data together. And what you can do on the Internet now is, rather than it being a medium where you go anonymously and no one knows who you are and you all see the same thing as everyone else, you can have access to the same information as billionaires and anyone else, everything that you see on the Internet increasingly is being shaped just for you based on your profile, which is because these companies track everywhere you go online. They know everything about you. If you use Gmail like I do, if you use Facebook, anything you do online, basically companies collect all the information. They plant cookies. They know everything about you. Well, the politicians are doing this, and it's gotten us to a situation where the Obama administration had an incredibly sophisticated method of reaching out to voters where they knew exactly what messages, what buzzwords worked with each voter. It was really high science. They had tremendous computer power on it. And we're looking at a future now where we're in the near future where politicians are going to be able to send specially crafted messages to each of us saying what we'd like to hear. And only we will be able to get them. It won't be like universally shared so you can debate them with your friends. And it's really sort of a dystopian future, a near future, unless, you know, the face of us.
Very interesting. Bobby Chesney, co-author of Dollarocracy with John Nichols. Bob, I'm actually going to offline. I'm going to invite you to come back next week. I'd like to do things in depth. And you are one of the masters of what's been of corporate control of the media. So I'll send you an email if you want to come back on with me next week. That'll be fine. I want to focus a little more on the media and your other work in the media. This has been the Saratoga Green Power Wellness Show. We just down the last couple minutes here talking with Bob McChesney, very well respected. 23 books you've written. That's quite a bit. The book is How the Media and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, forward by Senator Bernie Sanders, who actually is living proof that if you're a backbencher, it means you have a backbone. And Bernie Sanders has certainly proven that over the years. What we've talked about here is the corporate power in American democracy, in decimating what we've had in American democracy, really sending us back to the era in the electronic age of the Gilded Age and the robber barons who truly ran the show in this country from the late 1800s into the 20th century. Now we're seeing it enforced by electronic means, but I am contending that a bit of it is falling apart due to the success of the Cultural Revolution, and that I don't think these guys are going to hold power for long. I will be talking next week with Bob and hopefully others about the Snowden, Bradley Manning, Julian Assange syndrome, and how the Internet plays into this as far as I'm concerned. The Internet really represents the horse out of the barn, and if we do have a chance at restoring our democracy at all, it's going to be through the Internet. So I'm interested to hear, Bob, your further opinions on the corporation's ability to manipulate it and what the limitations might be, because I think, actually, the Internet will ultimately be our tool to winning back our democracy as we get rid, hopefully, of electronic voting machines and all the other nonsense that pollutes our elections. Thank you so much this week, Bob McChesney, for being with us. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew at WWPRN.FM. Tune in anytime to the archives for the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. And again, a fond, loving and heartfelt farewell to Toshi Seeger. Toshi, we will miss you. We love you. It's been such a joy to have you on the planet with us. Pete will take us away now with the Solartopia song, and we will see you all next week at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks so much, Bob.
Solartopia, Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna